Good evening, everybody. Thank you for being here. And I'm changing the title of my talk just a little bit. The name of my talk is My Journey, Discovering White Privilege, : Learning to Practice in the Gap. So some of you were here last year, and maybe you remember that in winter quarter we had a 3-month program that was really dedicated to exploring our diversity statement, which is on our website, and which says that our highest value of Buddhist practice is to shine the light of awareness on habits of mind that perpetrate prejudice and discrimination, so all may we wake up together. And for those of you who are here, we did a lot of exploring. We did some study. We had panel discussions. And Reverend Zenju Ursuline Emanuel led us in a day-long retreat. And I thought that this was, you know, a very significant time of exploring together. But at the same time, I felt like something was missing. Like there was a certain kind of depth, maybe, that we didn't know how to tap into. So that kind of became my inquiry during this past year to kind of see what that might be. And so in September, I went to a one-day workshop on Dharma and White Privilege led by Chris Fortin and Crystal Johnson. And in that time, we had a very safe environment where we were invited as white people to explore our white privilege and to understand its connection to racism. And then I'm very grateful to my youngest daughter, Carrie Katona, and her wife, Roz Katona, who are both social justice activists by profession. And they're very comfortable and very skillful and loving about being able to raise issues of racism and white privilege in dialogue. And especially when they lived with us for 3 months, we had a lot of conversations. And Carrie, my daughter, she discovered this program called the Safety Pin Box. And it was a program developed by two African-American women activists to find a way to, in a sense, teach white people about white privilege. And every month we got a box in the mail. And in the box were descriptions of African-American women who were developing social service projects and research that we were invited to conduct, inquiries and reflections, and social action steps. We paid $100 a month to receive this box, and for every person who gave $100, this money was donated to the one African-American woman who was developing her own entrepreneurial project, and it was understood that this was an act of reparation. So I felt like I was taking a graduate course, really. It was incredibly enlightening and challenging. And so through, I guess, all these experiences, I wanted to share with you some of what I've learned about white privilege and its connection to racism, but also how we can even come to understand white privilege. So to start with, I want to remind us, you know, maybe you know of Joanna Macy, who's a internationally known Buddhist activist, and she says, we're all made of the same stuff, earth, air, fire, water, spirit. That's all sentient beings, plants, animals, humans, of all colors, ethnicities, sexual orientation, and more. Really, this physical truth is the basis of the wisdom we practice, the interconnectedness of all beings, the delusion of an individual self, and the bodhisattva belief that no one is liberated until we're all liberated. So it so happens this past year I found an article in the New York Times reporting a research study in the journal Nature. And in this report, they were reporting on three separate genetic studies, all done completely independent of each other, collecting genomes from 787 people of different indigenous communities. So this was a different kind of genetic study because usually genetics are done on European people and sometimes Chinese people, but these were indigenous people. All of these studies, it was reported, conducted independently, came to the same conclusion. People everywhere descend from one single migration of early humans from Africa and point to an exodus somewhere between 80,000 and 50,000 years ago. So if we're all made of the same stuff and we all come from the same DNA root, what happened? How can it be that even before we became a nation, the early settlers were engaged in slave trade from Africa? How could it be that the truth in our that our nation was built on the backs of slaves, people from Africa, people from the same origins as us, yet our ancestors decided we are justified in creating slavery because the people brought over from Africa and the Native Americans whose land we took were less than human. And this was the beginning of white privilege. So I wanted to know, well, what is white privilege? And I read an article by Peggy McIntosh, maybe some of you know of it. And she says, white privilege is an indivisible or is invisible package of unearned assets that's perpetuated through the structures of society. This advantage, and it's an unearned advantage, is reinforced every day because white privilege is invisible. And these structures sustain a comfortability of life for us. As a white person, she says, I realized I'd been taught about racism as something that puts others at a disadvantage, but had not been taught to see one of the corollary aspects, white privilege, which puts me at an advantage. So I'm learning that what is so insidious is that as a white person, I don't have to look at this truth because there's really nothing disadvantageous about being white. My life isn't controlled or disempowered because of my skin color. I don't have to face the reality of racial violence because this violence isn't part of my everyday life. One of the women in the workshop I went to, she commented that when the TV was showing all the violence in Charlottesville, Virginia last August, and I guess there was another march this weekend, she realized she didn't have to watch it. She could just turn the TV off. But African Americans across our nation live with the threat of violence every day. So how do we make what's invisible visible? How do we address the ways in which our white privilege perpetuates suffering in the world? So my intent for tonight is to share with you some of what I've learned, and then hopefully we can do an exercise together. And I hope to present this in a loving way. This isn't about being judged or feeling guilty. This is about giving ourselves permission to look within and learn more about ourselves. White privilege not only sustains racism, but keeps us entrapped in the delusion that we're separate people. So I asked myself, well, when did I learn I'm white? And I thought, well, maybe when I was three. And my grandfather hired an African American minister to work for him. back then, black ministers weren't paid, so they had to find another source of income. Walter was his name. He was a very kind man who dutifully served our family Christmas meals. Imagine being a minister and not being able to celebrate Christmas with your family. He would serve us our abundant meals and then retreat to the dark back room and sit there while we ate. When I would go back there, age 3 or 4, to use the bathroom, there he was, sitting there with such dignity and presence. I realized I loved Walter. I felt more comfortable back there in the dark room than with my family. Our family would visit his family once a year with gifts, but we never invited him to our house. I knew then, I think, without words or concepts, that something was very wrong here. For some reason, as I grew older, I wanted to be friends with people of color, and I just couldn't understand why it never happened. Or maybe I learned I was white when I lived in Kenya for 3 months, out in the bush with the Kuria people, helping to build a science laboratory. This is the first time, as a white person, I was in a minority. I'll never forget getting off the plane in Nairobi and seeing hundreds of black Africans of different shades of black. But as I lived there for a while, I began to realize something, that I could differentiate physical features that distinguished different tribes, like the Kuria tribe or the Kikuyu tribe, but I had great difficulty with facial recognition. It was very hard for me to distinguish specific facial features on black faces so that I could link the face with the name. All this time, I knew something was wrong. I was trying to work against discrimination, but I didn't understand that most of the advantages I'd been given in my life were the result of racism. So this idea of passive advantage is important. These advantages are just given to us, and this distinguishes white privilege from overt bias or prejudice. These advantages include cultural affirmations of our own worth, presumed greater social status, freedom to move, buy, work, play, speak freely. The effects can be seen in professional and educational contexts. This concept of white privilege also implies that somehow what we think is truth is the universal truth. Thinking that others who are different are exceptions and we're the norm. I just learned recently, there's a book that's just been published that documents that all of the Ivy League schools on the East Coast were basically financed through merchants who made a lot of money off the slave trade. This is Yale, Harvard, Princeton, Wellesley. Yeah. And then I thought, oh, my grandmother finished college, my great-grandmother finished college, my grandmother, my mother, myself, two of my daughters, we all have advanced degrees. It's not because we're smart. So as I go on, I realize this is a delicate topic. And there's a lot of documentation by black people that white people easily become very defensive when confronted with our own racism. This has now been described as white fragility. There's a sociologist, Robin DiAngelo, who wrote a book about this. She says, there's a kind of fragility in white people when engaged in conversations or being confronted about racism, that instead of engaging the conversation and listening, white people try to defend themselves by explaining how, oh, I'm not racist, or collapse into emotions such as guilt or fear, or just go silent and withdraw. She says, I have found that the only way to give feedback without triggering white fragility is to give none at all. There are also many African Americans who now don't even want to talk to white people about racism. Jim? Yes.
And racism. So we were talking, because it seemed like the conversation or the talk just shifted, and I'm just wanting to understand if there's any, are they synonyms for in your research, or how do they play together, or how do they work together?
Well, it sounds like initially white privilege is the result of racism that started way back, the way that the structures of society were built to favor the advantage of white people at the cost of basic humanity for black people. But now the challenge is for us to become aware of all the ways in which we're functioning in this white privilege but aren't aware of it. And that this is sort of the pathway through to ending racism. Because right now, we're sort of, to the degree that we can't engage in this exploration, we're sort of keeping things the way they are. And maybe it'll come more clear as I go on, but I don't know if that gives you some clarity.
I get what you're saying, that white privilege underpins, that racism underpins white privilege.
Right.
And white privilege perpetuates racism.
Correct. Okay. That's it. Yes. So basically, now, and I am a little worried about time, because we started late, and what? Well, I want to have an exercise too, but as I talk further, I guess I'm wanting to share more of how I tried to work with these defenses. I mean, these are kind of defenses that we as white privileged people live from outside of our awareness, and how can we help each other become more aware? So even as I'm talking, notice your responses. Like maybe some of you are saying, well, yes, but, or one of you might think, oh, that doesn't apply to me, or I can think of all the ways in which I'm not racist, or you might even say, I wish I didn't even stay for this talk. I mean, just sort of notice your own reactions, because this could be understood to be a kind of defensiveness. It's like it's a way that we don't have to look at ourselves in this way. So again, no judgment. This is all part of our own inquiry, really. These are our hindrances in our practice. So there's some beliefs that I began to become more aware of that sort of reinforce our white privilege. One belief is that what we think is best is really the most reasonable, universally best thing for all people. That it's very hard to see that that thought is a reflection of our white privilege. It's not necessarily what's true for other people. To be aware of a belief in the myth that we are free to create our own destiny. That's the myth we grew up with. But when we believe that that's true, then we don't see the ways in which society is structured in such a way that many, many people aren't free to choose their own destiny. or even the belief that we have a right to a comfortable, peaceful life. And if we believe that, then it's then we don't want to turn towards what's uncomfortable. And yet, this is what I'm calling practicing in the gap. Until we turn towards what's uncomfortable, then we can't really come to a full experience of the interconnectedness of all beings. Because when we turn toward what's uncomfortable, then we begin to see the gap between how we see things and how other people see things. Just for an example, I think it was January, I participated in the Women's March that was here and many other places. Larry kind of organized it. And there was an African-American man who was selling T-shirts, you know, women's rights or human rights. And it was a great T-shirt. And I bought the T-shirt and I said to him, "Oh, what organization are you donating this money to?" Embarrassing. He looked at me and said, "Oh, this is to help me support my family." It's like, and then it's sort of like you feel this deep, dark bass chord on the piano gap. Here's my white privilege projected onto this person, and therefore I can't see who he is, what his life means. But even in that moment, I learned something. You know, I broke out a little bit of this perspective, so that I'm hoping that maybe my capacity for true empathy for another person could develop. So I also learned that we cannot forget that our nation was built on the back of slaves for the benefit of white people. Because we don't have to remember that, but black people have to remember it every day, and they have to remember to tell their children. I don't have to tell my grandchildren. So I, you know, I mean, I grew up in the 60s. I kind of knew about the civil rights. I wanted to march on Selma. You know, the consciousness was in the air. But I never took the time to really develop a timeline to really look at slavery, which began in 1619. The British brought it over to the Virginia colony. I learned that in 1705, Virginia adopted the one-drop rule. This is a statute that says, If a person has one drop of black ancestry, however small, they cannot be considered white. This was a legislative determination to keep the white race pure. And by 1810, I'm not good on numbers, but I really worked at this. By 1910, this rule was law in almost all the southern states. That's 200 years later. So 1776 was the Declaration of Independence, and slavery was legal. 100 years later was the abolition of slavery, but not really. Jim Crow laws, white supremacy, discrimination continued. And there were three voter rights acts to try to make sure nobody was discriminated or prevented from voting. And we still have that problem. So we as white people don't have to remember, but black people remember every day. There's a book called Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates. It's a letter he wrote to his son, and here's something he says to his son, who's African American. "Never forget that we were enslaved in this country long before, longer than we have been free. Never forget that for 250 years, black people were born into chains, whole generations followed by more generations who knew nothing but chains. The enslaved were not bricks in your road. They were people turned to fuel for the American machine. James Baldwin says, "To be a Negro in this country and to be relatively conscious is to be enraged most of the time." So I'm going to skip this part, but one of the other important parts of my learning is the importance of doing research. In the safety pin box, they didn't just tell us things. They said, look it up. And there was something about having to do my own investigation that is part of what's helping me address my white privilege. And it's teaching me more of the truth of the social structures that reinforce racism so that I can speak out with some authority. I can say something more than just something personal about me. Because that's part of this lifting the veil of white privilege, is to stop being silent and to say something. Just to say one thing, because this article was written by an African-American doctor who basically says that only 5% of the doctors in our country are black. 5%. And not only that, but the white doctors still sustain myths about the differences between black people and white people. Like, for example, a myth that black people are less sensitive to pain. So white doctors give black people less pain medication. It's stuff like that I've learned I have to do something about. I have to research, not read when you read the paper, it's like you read half the headline and that's about it. That's not what I'm talking about. I started to think about how, okay, this is up to us to explore our white privilege. It's not okay, it's not appropriate to go to a black person and say, tell me about racism. You know, that's not their job. But how do we learn? How do we appreciate the differences in our experience? So I found a video, and it was an interview of an African-American woman describing what it was like for her as a child to be told by her parents that her ancestors were slaves. I mean, to see the expression on her face, to feel the shock, the grief, the shame, the rage as it came through her, and how that changed her life at that moment. To me, that was another way I was practicing in the gap, you know, because that's totally outside of my realm of experience. So then I've been reading this book called Radical Dharma, written by Reverend Angel Kyoto Williams, who is the counterpart to Earthlyn Manuel Emmanuel. She's the only other Zen, African-American Zen priest who's transmitted. This is an incredible book, and in this book is a chapter by Jasmine Sedula. And I'm just going to read what she wrote, because here again, this is allowing me to practice in the gap, to read her story. She says, "I lived in predominantly white spaces my whole life. As a young person, I could not escape the everyday supremacy of whiteness. It saturated my Saturday morning television shows, my young adult reading practices. It followed me to school and found me in my dreams." And then she went to college and she took a religious studies course, and the requirement in that course was to meditate and to journal. And this is what happened. "After following my breath, I felt it. It's not bliss. It was not nirvana. It started in my stomach, a violent kind of grief-like pain. The slow eruption of shattered glass began to rise like a volcano up from my core, like so much indigestible garbage. I did not dare move. It was blinding rage. It was a bottomless sadness. I had been at home in whiteness so long, I had no idea how abandoned I felt in my own body. A sadness, a loneliness I did not understand, but did not want to go away. I was learning to tell the truth about myself, to stand up for her instead of running away. I was mining the painful ruins of my efforts to overcome this tokenized exceptionalism, the precarity of model minority meritocracy. I had been struggling to pass, not with my skin, because as the darkest in my family, looking white was far from fathomable, but by acting like my blackness didn't really matter. I had been unwittingly passing off rage as charm, and I had no clue how to stop." The privilege to read this is practicing in the gap. So this is just a beginning. I don't have any answers. Just the intention, I guess, to not live within my white privilege, but to do the inner work of seeing this invisible advantage so that by dismantling white privilege, we begin to heal the separateness, and we begin to live together in mutual respect and understanding, and to stand up when we see white privilege at work. So we can speak up, we can educate ourselves, we can work on our white fragility. We can be aware of our tendency to project what's best onto people of color. We can practice in the gap. What is blackness? What is whiteness? We're all made of the same stuff. We come from the same DNA root. But white privilege is invisible. It's comfortable. So we need to be intentional together. Let's work together. without shame or blame, but with love for everyone. So, thank you. So, I just see all of this as sort of little insights or little awarenesses. And this Peggy McIntosh has this wonderful list of very specific everyday ways in which we might benefit from white privilege. And many may not apply, and some might, but I thought I'm going to hand this out. And either we're going to divide up into pairs, and either you could just share something you learned about yourself through listening to my talk, or to pick one of these items that seems to speak to you and just share it with your neighbor. And if anyone here identifies as a person of color, then when you look at the list, I want you to see, okay, what of all of this has had the most impact on me in my life? Does this make sense? Okay.
You know, do I want to live what's on this list? And I don't think that that's the choice, but I think that that's probably part of why we keep sustaining it, is we like this privilege. I mean, there isn't anything here that I would trade for and say, this is what I want. Yeah. So I think this is, one more time, a beginning of this conversation, and thank you for continuing to bring it to the forefront. Mm-hmm.
I just want to reflect for a moment on this, because it's the first gathering that I've of any kind of theology where this is a part of the regular program. Directly to your point about the medical profession. One of the things that I think, you know, the next step needs to be for us to take direct positive action, to actively involve yourself in elements of discrimination that we gloss over. To that point, there is no evidence, there is no biological evidence of racial differences in any medical analysis or any medical research that has been done, period. And when you fill out a form at a doctor's office or a dentist's office or any kind of medical facility, you still will be asked what your race is. And it's up to you to circle that with a black magic marker and take it to the director of that facility and ream them out. Because that is, my point is, it's institutionalized to just reflect on your...
Thank you, Dorley, for this presentation. So I took some workshops some time ago on white privilege, and we went through stuff like this, and this is a great refresher for me, but what I wanted to mention tonight was after I'd become, the main experience I had was the realization not only that I have white privilege, but that I'm a racist, that my view of people of color is different than my view of white people. And I found that so liberating to understand that the depth of that delusion and how it fits squarely into my other delusions and hence my Buddhist practice. But it was a great gift. And I'm still, and I expect to be working with that the rest of my life because I was born white in America.